The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
As long as there's a 12-year-old with a plastic knife in Ukraine, there'll be Ukrainian resistance. The question is, do we want the Ukrainians to be fighting with plastic knives, or do we want them to be fighting with 155-millimeter artillery shells, which they desperately need? Those are the big questions right now. Those are the questions Ukrainians are asking me all the time. What do you think the Congress will do? I don't have a good answer for them. I really don't know whether the United States will live up to its promises.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 15th, 2024. It's the Ides of March, folks, and to mark the occasion of the assassination of Julius Caesar, I sat down with Tim Mack, calling into the Jungle Studio from the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv. Tim Mack is the editor, the writer, and the entrepreneur behind the Substack site, The Counteroffensive, which covers the Ukraine-Russia war through personal stories on the ground in Ukraine. He has been in Ukraine since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, when he was an NPR reporter, and he has done some of the best English-language reporting from that country. We talked about 2 years of the full-scale invasion. We talked about a decisive battle early in the war over the Antonov airfield. We talked about the current mood in Ukraine and how people are feeling about America as Congress dithers on Ukraine aid. And we talked about whether the Ukrainian military effort is sustainable. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 15th. Tim Mack on 2 years of war in Ukraine.
So, Tim, I want to start with where we left off the last time we talked on the Lawfare podcast, which was that the counteroffensive was starting, both on the ground as a Ukrainian military project and on Substack as a Tim Mack journalistic project. And now it was a very, I think, hopeful and exciting moment. Now we are some number of months later. It is a significantly less hopeful moment, but you haven't changed the name of the publication. So bring us up to date. Where are we in the Ukraine-Russia wars and your coverage of them?
Well, let's start with the publication, and then we'll get into the war. How about that? So the counteroffensive was a publication I launched last May. And what we've done is we tried to zoom in on personal stories as a lens through which we can view the war in Ukraine. And what we're aiming for is a more holistic form of war correspondence, telling the stories of the war through personal stories and using that empathy, that connection between people here in Ukraine and people thousands of miles away, as a way for us to tell deeper stories that we find that people would be more interested in. So over the last year, we've told stories about the trenches, but also stories about Ukrainian folk music and Ukrainian language dictation, stories about religion, stories about the cuisine here. And what we're trying to do is provide a much more comprehensive view of the war, of Ukraine, not just as a place where war is happening, but a place that's interesting in and of itself, where conflict just happens to be occurring. Now, you know, as the name suggests, we drove a lot of inspiration from that optimism of about a year ago, which was that Ukraine had liberated large portions of its territory and was planning to be on the march in a very aggressive counteroffensive. And that there was a lot of optimism and hopefulness about what that counteroffensive might be able to do. Here we are a year later, and the counteroffensive campaign, the Ukrainian operation, has stalled and could rightly be called, you know, the situation on the front rightly could be called a stalemate. And in fact, one in which Russia has seized the initiative. And when I say seize the initiative, what I mean is that they are able to dictate the tempo and places in which combat is now occurring, and that Ukraine is on the defensive. A big reason for that loss in optimism is a series of military operations last year, which did not break through Russian lines as hoped for. There are a number of reasons for that, and we can kind of get into it. But from a bird's eye view right now, what I can say is that, you know, the pessimism and morale in Ukraine is about as low as I've ever seen it. And you know, it's palpable. There's a lot of people who have spent more than 2 years now fighting in pretty horrifying conditions, with no end in sight, with no kind of broad strategy from the Ukrainian government as to what happens next. And that's not all the Ukrainian government's fault. The Ukrainian government can't plausibly create a strategy for how to win the war if they don't know what tools they'll have to use. And America's reluctance and dithering on the issue of aid to Ukraine has kind of stalled things at a strategic level here in Ukraine. And that has impacts not just on a military planning level, but you just put yourself in the position of a 25-year-old Ukrainian male who's interested in mobilizing, trying to decide whether or not to join the military. And I got to say, I mean, a lot of people would rightly be reluctant to put their lives on the line when they don't know that the government has a clear strategy for how to proceed and how to win. But that all starts with, you know, did Ukraine's allies and friends who've promised to be with Ukraine till the end, did they just lose focus? Did they just lose their own initiative? Did they just get distracted by other kind of foreign policy shiny objects? And, you know, how much blame will Ukrainians have in the medium term? How much betrayal will they feel in the medium term, having been encouraged to fight by its Western allies and then possibly, depending on what happens next, abandoned at their moment of greatest need? But these are kind of the big things that I'm thinking about right now.
Yeah, so let's start with that sense of abandonment and betrayal. You know, you've framed it in the future tense. How betrayed will people feel? How abandoned will people feel? Let's talk about that question in the present tense for a minute, because if I were Ukrainian watching U.S. domestic politics and watching the congressional front in this war, I would feel abandoned and betrayed already. And so I want to turn your question on the present tense and just ask you, is that sense of betrayal extant already, or is there a tolerance for the idea that the United States has its own domestic politics and, you know, in a kind of Churchillian way, we will do the right thing after exhausting all other possible alternatives?
I wanna say that it's deep, deep frustration that hasn't yet coalesced into a sense of betrayal. But that's imminent, right? I think that the sense of betrayal calcifies if there's a final policy decision that's made in the United States, and the choice is made not to proceed with aid or to with, you know, essentially withdraw from supporting Ukraine. I don't think they're there yet. And I think that, you know, Ukrainians have sufficient memory to recall that the city that I'm in, Kyiv, might not be in Ukrainian hands without American support. And so there's still a surplus of goodwill there. That said, I think that, you know, if America and the U.S. Congress doesn't get its act together soon, I think it will turn into a sense of betrayal.
So let's talk about the different components here, because one that we hear about a lot is the American dithering and, you know, people like me who shine lasers on buildings to remind people of the dithering are kind of obsessed with that. But there is also some significant failure on the Ukrainian government's part, starting with the overpromise of the counteroffensive. And that has, as it became clear that that was not going to pan out in the fashion that many people expected it to, including clearly the Ukrainian leadership, there has been something of a return of politics to Ukraine at a domestic level. So talk about that. How angry are people at their own government's failure to deliver what had been, if not explicitly promised, at least impliedly promised?
Yeah, I mean, as time goes on, Zelensky's approval rating has dropped, but it's dropped from, you know, the 90s to a level that any Western politician would be very glad to have any day of the week, you know, down to the, you know, the 60s and 70s. I think what you're alluding to is the removal of the top military commander in Ukraine, General Zaluzhny, who was removed after a series of comments that included an acknowledgement to the Economist magazine that the war had reached a stalemate. And that concession is the classic political gaffe, which is the, you know, accidentally telling the truth when it's not in alignment with the political class's interests and messaging. And the interesting thing is that Zaluzhny is probably the only person in Ukraine with a higher approval rating than Zelensky himself, that the military retains a huge amount of trust, that frontline troops have a huge amount of respect for Zaluzhny, and he was recently removed, and he remains an advisor and is now going to take a diplomatic role with the Ukrainian government in the United Kingdom, so out of Ukraine. There is a significant amount of frustration to the extent that I have not seen before. There are a lot of questions being asked about the Ukrainian government and whether it's made the right decisions, both in terms of the counteroffensive. And then, of course, people are asking, how did Ukraine get into this position in the first place? Why was Ukraine in such a vulnerable position when the full-scale invasion began? And even questions all the way back to the 90s and Ukraine's decision to give up its stockpile of nuclear weapons in exchange for security assurances that obviously weren't worth very much given the subsequent invasion by Russia. I think that there's a lot of political discussion right now, which is something that hasn't been as present over much of the last 2 years. Here's the issue. There's no election in sight. Originally, prior to the full-scale invasion, this month, this March, there were scheduled to be elections in Ukraine. But constitutionally, from a legal perspective, the Ukraine cannot have an election while there's martial law and when there's a war underway. So from a legal perspective, there isn't this release valve for people to be able to express their opinions on things like, you know, should Ukraine negotiate with Russia and under what, on what terms, and what would be appropriate to concede, if anything. What would be the appropriate strategy for winning the war? What does victory mean? And what are we willing to do in order to achieve victory? What kind of sacrifices are we willing to do? Is another round of mobilization, is that appropriate? You know, a lot of people are reluctant to mobilize hundreds of thousands of more people, which is probably what would be needed in order to continue the prosecution of this war. You know, so all these issues are present in Ukrainian society, but because of the law prohibiting these elections, they're not really able to be discussed in a frank way. And you know, public surveys right now show that most Ukrainians don't want an election, don't feel like it's appropriate for both the legal reasons and for the reason of logistics, which is the second kind of main barrier, that it would be difficult to have free and fair elections while there's active combat and there's many soldiers on the front lines, and that would be difficult to create a system to allow them to vote. And then finally, there's the issue of potential disenfranchisement, which is, you know, what do we do about all these people who are Ukrainians living behind Russian lines in occupied areas? How will they be represented, if at all? All those challenges make it so that politics are much more difficult and elections are much more difficult to conceive of now or in the near future.
But, you know, eventually you run into this problem as a democratic society fighting an authoritarian society, that your claim to be a democratic society when you're in a persistent state of martial law without a renewed mandate for the incumbent administration, you know, the British government did it for a long time during World War II. I think they suspended elections for the entirety of the war. It's not undoable, but it does create a real friction with the idea of a democratic society. Is there any discussion about how you preserve your democratic legitimacy and your status as a free society in a martial law situation where you're suspending elections over a long period of time?
The World War II comparison is interesting because you'll remember that that the British government created a coalition government that was as broad as possible, and Churchill specifically wanted to bring in people who had been antagonists in order to broaden the legitimacy of his coalition government. And then you can, of course, point to the United States having held elections during periods of unrest and during the Civil War. And there's a history of that as well. That said, the public opinion polls just do not show an interest in elections right now. The vast majority of people would oppose it if it were brought up as something that they could potentially do. I think most Ukrainians that I've spoken to on this matter would say that they need to focus on winning the war before they can continue with elections. Now, Ukrainians do not have a history over the last 20 years of staying quiet when they have demands. There have been, over the last 20 years, two major street protest-driven revolutions that have compelled political change in this country. So I think Ukrainians very instinctively understand that if it gets to a point where they feel like they're no longer able to express their voice, they know exactly what to do. And they've shown that they can compel change by doing it. So, I mean, that's the situation that's in place right now. I think that many Ukrainians would chafe at the suggestion that outsiders ought to come in and dictate to them how their democracy ought to operate. And when they should hold elections, and you know, the extent to which they can be considered a free society. From my window, I hear demonstrations in central Kyiv on a very frequent basis. And they're certainly free to do that in ways that you could not do in Moscow.
So I agree with you. I have heard no criticism of the government for not holding elections, or for not seeking what would really be required, which is seeking a legal change in order to hold elections. One thing I have heard criticism of the government for a lot recently is press freedom issues, and the sense that the Zelensky government is playing tough with the press. There's been some visible friction between the Zelensky government and the Kyiv Independent, the major English language publication. And there's a fair bit of criticism of Ukrainian language media for mostly sort of self-censorship kind of things. I have not spent the time to try to evaluate these criticisms. I'm curious, as a working journalist in in Kyiv. How is the atmosphere for you, and how is the atmosphere for your Ukrainian colleagues writing for Ukrainian publications?
Let me separate those two questions. I think that the Ukrainian press is, I would say, relatively concerned. I wouldn't say it's their number one priority. Is that they're worried that the government is cracking down or anything? And I see no evidence of a large scale crackdown. But there have been some specific episodes of, the government surveilling journalists, which have been publicized and criticized by Zelensky himself. From in a day-to-day perspective, what I'd say is when the full-scale invasion started in 2022, people were very eager to tell their stories. And they were very eager to talk to the press and talk about what they've experienced. 2 years into the war, I think, and this may be a reflection of general morale and exhaustion, people are just less open than they used to be. And I'm not talking about the government and suppression here. I'm talking about the average person. It's gotten a little harder to do the work of journalism because I think people are just utterly worn down. I don't think I could, I've tried in some of our writing on the counteroffensive to convey the fatigue and the grind that is living in a place like Kharkiv or in eastern Ukraine or even in Kyiv, where the news is just constantly bad, even when there are kind of ongoing victories on the battlefield. Everyone's getting, all sorts of people around you are getting terrible news on a regular basis. And the war has this horrific, traumatic effect on people. It wears down even the most psychologically tough folks that I knew over the last couple of years that I thought were just totally solid and totally unbeatable mentally, are starting to get ground down, starting to reach their limit in ways that are really surprising to me. And I've never seen this before. The distress from folks who've been fighting for more than 2 years is really very extreme.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me. And it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers, and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have my life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
So what is the realistic consequence of that? So you have a country that is genuinely worn down and yet has no, I think quite intentionally, has no vocabulary of compromise. There's no discussion, could we live with a ceasefire in place? At least not that I've heard. There's no discussion of, oh, could we have a peace on the basis of de facto Russian annexation of Crimea or Donetsk and Luhansk. There's no sense that, you know, oh, Mariupol is gone. And so how does the determination that this war isn't over until there's victory, and victory means something that most Americans think is a little bit unrealistic, which is the liberation of all occupied Ukrainian territory. How does that determination, which really constrains political vocabulary, collide with this sense of exhaustion and low morale that you're describing?
I think what we're getting into is the question of, you know, how does this all end? And can negotiations and discussions about ceasefires and an end to the war really take place, at least from the Ukrainian perspective? You're seeing in public opinion polls an openness to negotiations on some terms is ticking up. But I would say that that most Ukrainians are not yet ready to concede that. I think that most Ukrainians haven't been pushed to the point where they would need to concede that. Strategically, it seems obvious to, you know, the American military analysts that I talk to that in order to gain any more strategic objectives, Ukraine is going to need to mobilize a significant percentage of the population, hundreds of thousands of new people. When faced with that decision to either negotiate or mobilize, I think there'll be a different, you know, it will settle out that question of openness or not openness in a very stark way. But that decision hasn't been made politically yet. And so right now it's a pretty abstract idea to just go up to a Ukrainian and say, do you support negotiations or victory? I think the vast majority are going to say, let's stick with it. And so right now there just isn't that appetite, but there are going to be events this year that push more dilemmas for Ukraine. And people, the Ukrainian people will have to make that decision as to what to support and what not to support. Zelensky himself has not given an inch on any of this. And he claims that, Ukraine will not give up any claims to any of its territories. Only that can be the basis for any negotiations.
So I want to ask you, before coming back to the publication, I want to ask you about the reaction in Ukraine to the killing of Navalny. There is, at least in the Ukrainian population abroad, a real hostility to Navalny, and that, you know, came out both whenever he would do something that would acquire a lot of Western admiration, but also a sort of very reserved reaction to his death. On the other hand, quietly, a bunch of Ukrainians have expressed admiration to me just about his courage and about the fact that he was a, if not a Boris Nemtsov figure, certainly somebody who was opposed to Putin in a way that was significant and courageous in a time that mattered. What has been the reaction to you about this figure that the rest of the world admires so much and yet had this history of less than attractive statements that, you know, about which Ukrainians have a long memory, and who never kind of full-throatedly said Ukraine is a sovereign integral state, that Russia has no claim on any of its territory, including the parts that have been annexed?
We're stepping into a highly contentious topic here in Ukrainian society, and I think it can be summed up in the question, is there such a thing as a good Russian? And I think many Ukrainians would tell you no, that Navalny, who has a history, as you alluded to, of making comments about Ukraine that Ukrainians find imperialistic, and was part of, was a political candidate in Russia who espoused a number of imperialistic, nationalistic views, particularly when he was running for mayor. You know, many Ukrainians would make the argument that Russians come from this sort of colonialistic viewpoint. They're grown in it. They learn in it and they convey it. And that unless they're fighting for Ukraine against Russia, they're part of the problem. That's not my view. That's a view that's been expressed to me countless times here in Ukraine, that Navalny opposed Putin for his own personal sake and not for the liberation of Ukraine or the easing of Ukraine's suffering. That said, I have spoken to some Ukrainians that will say, hey, look, Navalny may not have been pro-Ukraine, but you can at least acknowledge that he had the courage of his convictions and returned to Russia when death was the inevitable outcome of that decision. But I've had countless conversations with people and in Ukraine, and they've dismissed my Western liberal view on this, which is that people ought to be judged on their individual views, actions, statements, and philosophies, rather than the group from which they happen to come from. The Ukrainian view on this is obviously grounded in a lot of anger over the deaths of many of their fellow citizens, over a war that never needed to happen.
Yeah, so I want to come back to your phrase, there's no such thing as a good Russian, which is something that if you spend time in Ukrainian communities, and for listeners who are going to get angry at me about this, you just hear all the time. And And yet each one of these Ukrainian communities has Russians in it, sometimes in relatively sizable numbers. And so, like, the group of people that I have gotten to know in Washington as a result of my embassy projection projects, there's a bunch of Russians who are working with them every day. And if you ask, I'm going to keep names out of this, but if you ask the, you know, Ukrainian who will look you in the face and say, in all seriousness, there's no such thing as a good Russian, what about so-and-so, right? Who, you know, they'll say, oh, that's different. And it is not obvious from an outsider point of view what actually makes it different. But it is something, there's some test that once people pass, they are accepted. And Navalny never passed that. And even though in his later years, he made clear he was talking about 1990 borders, 1991 borders, which of course include Crimea. He, in a number of coded ways, he opposed the war very actively. But he never said it in the kind of full-throated way that gets you over that hill of mistrust.
I think it may be helpful to go back to the root of why it is that many Ukrainians have this view of collective guilt on the Russian part. And that is, they look at their own history over the last two decades. They look at their street protests and their demonstrations and their demands and how they forced on two occasions the Orange Revolution and the Revolution of Dignity, change in their own system. And they look at the failure of liberal-minded Russians to do the same and say that that is a kind of collective failure on that should lead to guilt in all of Russian society and all of the Russians who did not successfully overthrow their government like we did. I think that would be a key argument for them. They would say, we managed to do it. Your failure to do it means you didn't really want it, and therefore you couldn't be grouped together in condemnation or as being part of that autocratic system. And to be fair to that point, the vast majority of Russians do support the Putin regime, and the vast majority of Russians see no problem whatsoever in the war. But, you know, from my liberal-minded view, we still ought to judge people based on their individual attributes and not based on their collective attributes. But I've had endless conversations on this topic with Ukrainians.
So in connection with the second anniversary of the full-scale invasion, you guys ran an incredible piece about one of the early battles of the war, which many listeners will remember. This was the battle over an airfield that was kind of pivotal in the battle for Kyiv. So talk about the battle and talk about the story you wrote about it.
Yeah, so like I said, the perspective of the publication is to do these kind of first-person reports, try to put you in an immersive way in the perspective of people who are going through the news. And so what we really wanted to do was tell the story of this battle called the Battle of Antonov Airfield, which I think is the most important battle of the war. It happened in the first 72 hours of the full-scale invasion when Russian elite airborne troops tried to capture an airfield just outside of Kyiv. And what they had was a plan to land about a dozen and a half huge Russian cargo planes filled with 1,000 soldiers and armored vehicles right outside of Kyiv and use that to encircle the city. And what we do is we spent months and months trying to understand how that battle took place and give some detail about how the Ukrainians denied the Russians that ability and essentially in the process saved the city of Kyiv and likely saved Zelensky's life. And it all came down to a small set of decisions. You know, what we do is we detail how four artillery pieces that just arrived by rail car into, you know, central Kyiv just that day managed to get into position to fire shells onto the airfield right in time to prevent the landing of these huge cargo planes. The whole war's outcome could be substantially different if there hadn't been a series of non-combat troops that were nearby and were just using small arms to fight off elite Russian troops. I mean, it's a really amazing story of just how much Ukrainians, you know, were driven to fight off the Russian invasion. There's a story in it about someone fighting on the Russian side, not having any ammo left, and deciding, and upon spotting Russian soldiers on the road around the airfield, just hitting the gas and running over Russian soldiers with his BMW. And I think this has some, you know, items for reflection and consequences for today, which is, you know, as bad as morale might be on the front lines from individual soldiers who are exhausted, Ukraine and the vast majority of Ukrainians have pretty deep motivation to fight and protect their cities and their country. The question is, are they going to get the equipment that they need and the support that they were promised from the West to fight on and yield, whether it's continued battlefield gains in Ukraine or being able to approach negotiations from a position of strength where they have the initiative on the battlefield and they're able to extract concessions. And, you know, I think that's going to be the big question. As long as, you know, I remember someone saying very early in the full-scale invasion that as long as there's a 12-year-old with a plastic knife in Ukraine, there'll be Ukrainian resistance. The question is, do we want the Ukrainians to be fighting with plastic knives or do we want them to be fighting with 155-millimeter artillery shells, which they desperately need? Those are the big questions right now. Those are the questions Ukrainians are asking me all the time. What do you think the Congress will do? I don't have a good answer for them. I really don't know whether the United States will live up to its promises.
So one thing I'd like you to shape for the listener is that battle for Antonov Airfield, and I will note that the Russian ambassador to the United States is also named Antonov, so it's always given this story has a particular resonance for me. You know, how much of it was a victory of the Ukrainian military and is a kind of top-down, our generals beat your generals kind of like Patton versus Rommel kind of, and, you know, but a big part of the story is just individual people taking individual actions, which is also part of the kind of Ukrainian military, a much less centralized kind of vision of, particularly in the early days of the conflict, a much less centralized approach to conflict. So, like, walk us through how much of this was resistance and how much of this was the armed forces of Ukraine beating the Russian army and elite paratroopers.
This was a story of resistance, not of good planning. There was a National Guard unit stationed at Antonov Airfield. This is just an example. The vast majority of its combat troops had been shipped away from Antonov Airfield in anticipation of possible combat actions in the east. And this is despite American warnings that Antonov Airfield might be a target in a renewed Russian invasion. So the Ukrainians knew that it could be a target and had not exhibited the proper planning to secure that airfield. The only thing that stopped them were a bunch of HR soldiers and a bunch of non-combat soldiers, a bunch of conscripts fighting their hearts out with very limited resources to beat back elite paratroopers. We're talking at this point, anyone with a rifle who was living near the range was, you know, was living near the airfield was taking pot shots at landing Russian troops. People were running around without appropriate body armor with a single magazine for their AKs, totally unequipped, totally unprepared, but totally motivated to prevent the Russians from getting a foothold near Kyiv. And by a combination of that motivation and resistance and luck, the timing worked out that a small number of artillery pieces were able to reach the within range of the airfield and destroy it. You cannot really say the generals were so well prepared and, you know, and outmaneuvered the Russians. And you know that, I mean, Zelensky till almost the moment of the full-scale invasion was trying to tamp down speculation that it would occur, even though the United States was screaming from every hill that it could find that an invasion was imminent. Yeah, I think that what happened was that you saw the spirit of Ukrainian people acting as individuals trying to do the best they could for their country. And in the end, there was enough luck and there was enough effort to be able to prevent the encirclement and occupation of Kyiv, which is why I'm able to talk to you from the city today, in my opinion, is this battle, is the outcome of this battle. Because having failed to secure that airfield, Russian troops were then forced to go over land, and they got stuck in that terrible quagmire that you'll remember from the early days of the war, these huge columns of easily targetable Russian troops running out of gas, running low on supplies, and just getting torn up by Ukrainian defenders from all sides. That was only possible because they were denied this air bridge in Antonov Airfield. And so it's a really compelling and interesting story. This is why I wanted to dig into it so much, is because I really think that was the pivotal moment.
So we are again at a pivotal moment. And as you describe, kind of big decisions, both on the U.S. side and the Ukrainian side, are, you know, going to happen in the next 3 to 6 months. As you look forward, what are the big things that you are watching at the macro level?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, whether it's a discharge petition, whether it's whether the speaker somehow is convinced to bring it to the floor, the big strategic question is, will U.S. aid resume to Ukraine? And if not, when will we know for sure? Failing that, does the Biden administration decide to use some of its other authorities to provide stopgap assistance in some way? How big will that be? That's a major unanswered question. The second question is one that's both political and military related, which is whether the political class in Ukraine will decide for another round of mobilization, and how large will it be? And what will be the pushback from Ukrainian society? Many Ukrainians don't want their children to be sent off to war, and who could blame them? But I think that they'll ultimately be forced to choose between the status quo and negotiations or another round of mobilization, because the soldiers on the front lines have been fighting now continuously for more than 2 years. We don't expect that of any American soldier. You know, American soldiers are typically rotated in theater during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars for periods of between 3 months and 9 months. These soldiers have been fighting in trenches with hardly any breaks at all. We're talking maybe 10 days off in 2 years in appalling conditions and under constant stress and threat of death. And their ability to be effective for, you know, offensive operations is, I think, pretty limited without new trainees coming in to alleviate some of the burden. Those are going to be the big macro issues that I look at. Outside of Ukraine, I'm really interested in, you know, how this isn't merely a war between Russia and Ukraine, but it's a battle between the world's democracies and the authoritarian ends who oppose it. You see Chinese messaging in Taiwan about how you can't trust Americans, and what they point at is how the United States hasn't kept its word in defending Ukraine to the extent that it's said that it would from the beginning. China is trying to use this struggle and American reluctance as a way to drive a wedge between Taiwan and the United States. China probably will likely use that same line with, you know, South Korea or Japan, and point out or argue that the United States can't ultimately be trusted. They can only be trusted for as long as they have attention on your conflict, and when there's some shiny new development, they'll get distracted and move on to something else. You know, so I'll be watching that really closely. Actually, the counteroffensive has launched a Taiwan monthly supplemental. So we're covering the Taiwan situation pretty closely as well. And it's a topic that really deeply interests me too.
We're going to leave it there. The publication is The Counteroffensive. The name remains unchanged. My guest has been Tim Mak. Many of you know his voice from NPR, where he used to report from Kyiv. He's still reporting from Kyiv, but now on his own. Tim, so great to talk to you again.
Thanks so much. And your listeners can check out our publication at www.counteroffensive.news.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was me. I did it myself. Folks, some media companies have big publicity departments, and they do all kinds of, you know, promotions and ads and whatnot. We don't do any of that. Our publicity department is you guys. And the only way that we get spread around is when people share the Lawfare Podcast, when you put it on Pinterest or Reddit. That's what we need you to do. We need aggressive promotion of the Lawfare Podcast by you, the listeners. So share it, Facebook, Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, Threads, Mastodon, Spoutable, and of course, don't forget Blue Sky. Just Blue Sky the hell out of the Lawfare Podcast for me. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.